funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to live forever, either physically or spiritually? And why are we so eager to do so? For as far back as we can trace our own history, we humans have cared and grieved for our dead and gone to great lengths to extend our own existence, drawing on the promises of religion, the potential of science, or both. But despite all our efforts, we remain unable to keep human bodies alive for much more than a single century at the extreme. And while any hope we place in a metaphysical experience of eternity may be deeply comforting, we have no empirical evidence that it is available to even the most righteous among us. So why are we so obsessed with surpassing the limits of a human lifespan? Adam Leith-Gallner joins us to talk about his investigations into these questions. He is the former editor of Vice magazine and author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Adam, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You say that you are not interested in living forever. So what was the appeal to you of writing about people who are?
Well, I've always been interested in people who are obsessed with the impossible. I think that they make great characters, and I think they make for great stories as well. So although my own interest in immortality is not a personal obsession, I was more curious to learn about people who are obsessed with it.
You point out here that most of human immortality, when we think of it, we're actually referring to some kind of existence beyond death. And I suppose that's because we know that every physical body eventually dies.
Yes. It seems like that's one certainty, that upon death, our body, our physical body, decomposes and returns to the elements in its own way. But the real question that we have is what happens to our consciousness or our soul or our animating spirit, whatever religious people want to call it, whatever believers want to call it. It seems like, depending on the survey, 75% or 80% or even 95% of us believe in life after death. Even if we're not religious, we still hope that there is something to come after we die. And that's what's so fascinating to me, is that even though we know so much scientifically, but we can't quite be sure of what occurs to us at death. Is it just the end, or is it something more? And the stories that we tell are so meaningful about it, and that's what this book explores.
You know, this has been going around and around in my head since I read this book, and that is that whether we believe in heaven or not, we can certainly imagine it, right? We can imagine a life that's different from the one we have now. What is more challenging to imagine is simply not existing. It's like that's a bridge too far.
Yeah, there's this great line about consciousness trying to envision a lack of consciousness. Like, it seems that we have this bug built into our operating system that we cannot imagine what it would be like to no longer be able to imagine. We can't compare that to anything. And so, you know, the effort to do it, as this one writer said, causes the most tormenting dizziness. And I think that's what you're talking about as well when you say that it's been going around and around. It's like this thing where we try to say, what would it be like? And it's as impossible as trying to think thought. We cannot know. We can only tell stories about it. We can only believe. And that's the whole essence of immortality.
Part of the deal, of course, of existence as we know it is that, by definition, life requires death. Not only could evolution never happen if nothing ever died, but within a matter of days, the entire surface of the planet would fill up with living things.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the most warping parts of researching this book and speaking to people of so many different faiths, people with so many different belief systems, was encountering some people who would dispute that claim, people who would say that, you know what, it's not necessary for us to die. In fact, to think that we have to die is an outdated mode of thinking. We are meant to be immortal. These people are physical immortalists, and they think that most people who would agree that death is real and that we necessarily do at a certain point have to face this final moment of life, which is dying, they would say that that's almost like it's such a negative form of thinking that they call it deathism. They would say that to think that way is to be a deathist. And they want to eliminate that sort of thinking, the way that we've done away or have striven to do away with things like racism and sexism. They say that deathism is on the same level. That's how offensive they find it. And that's, to me, I say it's warping, because this book really attempts to allow all belief systems to coexist in a charitable fashion. Like, I'm not a judgmental person. I'm skeptical, but I'm also exploring with an open mind and speaking to people about their beliefs. But one of the hardest ones for me to work with was people who believe that we will not die and who are offended by the idea that we will die being a certainty. I'm still struggling with that one.
Well, I will say this. It sounds, on the one hand, if you think that it's just you, it sounds okay, but it's sort of hubristic to think that we're the generation that suddenly will claim dominion over death when no one ever has.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems that every generation, stretching back to prehistoric times, felt the same way. Like, we always thought that we were the one perfect generation that would figure everything out, or at least some of us always felt that way. And there are so many examples through history of these outlandish efforts to try to stymie death, to try to somehow avoid the unavoidable. And I mean, one of the ones that always sticks with me is that during Imperial China, in the times of the Han Dynasty and the Tang Dynasty, many emperors, talking about hubris, I mean, they had access to everything. They were all powerful. They were the rulers. And so they felt that they were eminently suitable to live forever. And, of course, all these potion peddlers and elixir salesmen popped up saying, hey, guess what? We have the secret to eternal life, and you can have it for a modest fee. And many of these emperors, like not one, but more like a dozen or more, died taking potions that were intended to make them live forever. They were often made out of mercury. They were early kind of chemical or alchemical experiments. But to me, that's this great, it's this great way of looking at human nature, you know, that we want immortality so badly that we're always ready to be swept away into unthinkingness. And I don't think we've changed all that much. I think that progress is real technologically. Obviously, you know, processing speeds get faster and microchips get greater speeds, et cetera. But has everything progressed over the past few centuries? Like, have our emotions changed since Shakespeare's time? I don't know. And I think that one of the things that has stayed with us is this innate desire to somehow transcend our limitations and find a way to live forever.
Well, and we think, again, if we're talking about physical immortality here, the interesting thing about the desire for that is that anyone who's been on this planet recognizes that the experience of life contains within it a great deal of suffering. That is something you can't escape.
It makes me think of one of these Facebook posts I saw recently by some transhumanists, and in their, you know, religious views, it said something like, abolishing all suffering. And I really thought, oh, that's so interesting, you know, that these people who do long for physical immortality also believe that there is a way to have life without suffering. I think that Buddhists wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah, and I guess
the first noble law is the idea that life entails suffering. That's their noble truth. That's the, like, essence of Buddhism. And here you have these radical futurists who are saying, that's not the way life needs to be.
Well, do you think, I mean, it almost requires us to ponder whether it's even moral to wish to live forever, considering the effect that would have on other human beings.
Yes, I think that the bioethics of physical immortality is a conversation that needs to be happening more. It's something that most of us haven't even heard of. You know, there was a survey that came out a week or two ago by the Pew Foundation, the Pew Center, and they, for the first time, asked Americans how they feel about the possibilities of radical life extension. And what they were asking people was, how would you feel about taking or accepting medical treatments that could allow you to live to be 100 or 120 years old or more? And the idea being that these treatments would allow you to be healthy until that age. Like, you wouldn't be just, you know, prolonging the pain-glazed years of senescence. You would be a healthy person up until 120. And most Americans said they wouldn't want that. And only 4% of Americans said they would actually want to live to be older than 120. Hmm. But the statistic that really stuck with me is they said, you know, have you guys heard about what's happening in terms of radical life extension? Are you aware of the experiments that are going on and the amount of money that is being put into this? And only 7% of Americans said that they had read a lot about this subject. Most had never even heard about it at all. And that, to me, was really mind-blowing because, you know, I've spent 5 years in this topic researching it and learning about it. And whenever I talk to people about it, most of my friends don't really know much about it. But in certain circles, people know a lot about it. But those are very kind of rarefied, exclusive circles of people who are passionate and sometimes obsessed with this subject. But how interesting that most of us don't know that, that this stuff is afoot. So when we talk about the moral implications of it, I do think that it's important to get the word out about what's going on in order for people to make up their own mind.
Well, of course, we know that the vast majority of Americans, something like 90%, do say they believe in God, and that may not come tied in up to a belief about immortal life, but very often it does. Mm-hmm. So I suppose many people might feel as if, you know, living longer is not necessary if there is something like so awesome it can't be described coming after my unfortunate demise.
That's a great way of putting it. I do think that that's one of the essential consolations of faith, is that it allows us to make sense of death and to make death meaningful. I think that if we don't have that, we might find ourselves struggling to create another narrative. And another possible narrative might be the idea of never dying, which is why I feel that these physical immortalists have basically transposed an ancient mythology into a kind of scientific context and are confounding the two in some very bizarre way.
How do you think our fears of our own death compare with the grief and anxiety we feel at the death of someone we care about?
I think grief is such a powerful and inescapable experience. It's when it happens to us, it's overwhelming. It's not everybody has been through it, and it seems like it's something that inevitably happens at some point. You know, grief overcomes us, and we find ourselves dealing with the terrible loss of someone we love so dearly, and trying to make sense of the fact that they had been here and now they are gone. And grief is such a potent reminder of our own mortality as well. And that's part of the conversation that goes on in our own mind, the relentless searching for answers in bereavement. If we're asking to compare grief to our own fear of death, I would say that grief often is a shorter experience. Hmm. I mean, there can be protracted and complicated grief, and for many people, like, a real powerful loss stays with them for the rest of their life in some way or another. But oftentimes we move through the heightened experience of grief in a few weeks or months, and we move on. You know, we come to accept what has happened. But dealing with our own mortality is more of a lifelong process.
My guest is writer Adam Leith-Gallner. His new book is called The Book of Immortality: The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Adam Leith-Gallner. He has written for publications including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Guardian. His new book is called The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You actually had, Adam, as a teenager, a near-death experience.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, my family had moved to Hungary shortly after communism ended. My father is Hungarian, and so he brought us back, and I was living there. And we lived next to a soccer field, and after class, the neighborhood kids would all gather there, and we'd play soccer games. And one day, I think it was a weekend, but I'm not sure, somebody brought a BB gun to the soccer field, and we all took turns firing it with no pellet inside it, just kind of just trying it out, and there was no talk of there being any ammunition for it. And then, you know, when we tired of it, we put it down on the bench and went to play a game, and we played, and my team lost. And then as a joke, oh, what a terrible joke, I picked up the gun and put it in my mouth and pulled the trigger, and somebody had placed a pellet inside it while we had been playing and left it there loaded. And the pellet went into my tongue and tunneled through the length of it, came out the back of my tongue and lodged itself in the back of my throat a few millimeters away from my spinal cord. And at the moment of impact, I kind of had an out of body experience, is what it's called. I floated up and looked down upon the soccer field and myself, and it all happened in this strange temporality. Like, it happened very slowly. It was like a very slow instant, and then I remember I zoomed back into my usual perspective, and a terrific amount of blood was pouring out of my mouth. And the thing that it left me with, well, I mean, I went to the hospital. The doctor was terrified of the situation, because if she pushed the pellet further, it could have meant terminal damage. It was a very high anxiety moment for everybody. But she got it out, and 3 days later, I left the hospital. I was fine. The strangest thing is that it never hurt me. It never hurt at all. And something like that should hurt us. And so the thing to me, the way I look at it, is first off, a near-death experience is not proof of anything. It is a real experience to those who've had it, and it's a significant amount of the population. It's somewhere between 4 and 15% of people who have near-death experiences. And some people decide that the near-death experience is proof of something to come, and that's fine. It's an interpretation of the experience. To me, it left me with no sense that there is or there is not something to come. That's not what it did to me. To me, what I really remember feeling was astonished that it didn't hurt, and I think that it must have been that the pain signals and my neurotransmitters were so overloaded with information that it just, you know, my brain had no way of understanding what was going on. It was such an intense pain that it just, you know, kind of immediately short-circuited it, and that might be the explanation for why I leapt out of my mind and looked down upon myself. But I don't know. I don't need an explanation. I don't think that, you know, it's just something that happened, and it's part of the strangeness of life, is that this happens. I think that there's this real desire in us to find stories that confirm our beliefs and our hunches about whatever it is. So there's a real reason why the number one bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list all year has been this book about the neuroscientist's near-death experience, with that great title, Proof of Heaven. Which obviously it cannot offer proof of heaven, but we have such a longing for stories like that, and that's why it connects with us on such a deep level. And, you know, whether it's true or not doesn't matter. It's a story, and it helps us make sense of death.
The striking thing about the success of that book is that, you know, a century ago, many of us would have been inclined to accept proof of heaven from, you know, our rabbi, our pastor, our, you know, some spiritual leader who said this exists, if you know, in particular faith traditions that believe in an afterlife. Today, it comes from someone who is a scientist. And I wonder how much you've thought about the replacement, even among people who have religious faith, of faith in just religion with some kind of a faith, if that's the right word, in science.
I thought about that a lot, and I think that it's a murky terrain to explore, and there's a lot of heightened sensitivities around that idea, especially amongst people who do turn science into a faith. I think that some of them, you know, great scientists are, you know, they're nonchalant about the limitations of the scientific method to answer every question. But some people who are sometimes pejoratively referred to as adherents of scientism, another ism, they would really take offense at that or take umbrage at the notion that, you know, that they've turned science into a belief, that, you know, science is the way that we can answer every question. That's how they feel about it. They're radical materialists, or they're fundamentalist atheists, and they take that very seriously. To me, I remember early on, I bumped into one of the big proponents of that ideology at an airport, and we were talking about it, and I said, you know, I'm working on this book, and sort of looking at how some people have turned science into a religion, and they said, well, science can absolutely be a religion. It's my religion. And I thought, oh, wow, I really want to quote you on that. But at the same time, I don't want to, you know, create that. I didn't want to bring them into this mess. And so I think that, yeah, you know, science is supposed to be the way we deal with everything that is knowable. And belief is supposed to be the way we approach the things that cannot be known. And belief helps us mediate our uncertainty about it.
What's so interesting and also ironic is that science continues to demonstrate for us in modern times how little we can trust our own perceptions, even those that would appear to be rather empirically derived.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's this one quote by John Gray, and he says, if we can know anything for sure, it's that all of the theories that at one time prevailed as the major way of making sense of things are now obsolete and no longer considered to be correct. So, yeah, science is continually evolving. It's an ever-unfolding process. And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, just to be clear about this, I love science. I value science. I use it every day. I see its benefits, and I'm not a detractor in any sense. I'm somebody who loves science, but who also loves religion and belief. And I love all systems of thought that attempt to make sense of our surroundings. So I have no axe to grind. I'm somebody who's open. But I do think it's interesting how some people overburden, whether it's science or faith, they overburden that system of making sense of the world and try to make it do something that it cannot do by its very nature. You know, religion cannot teach us about evolution. And just, by that same token, neither can science teach us about the afterlife. It can try, but it requires making a leap of faith, and that's not what science is supposed to be doing.
Do you think we would be less obsessed with this on either the religious or the scientific front if we actually knew, if we had conclusive evidence of what happens?
Well, I do think we would be less obsessed with it because it would no longer be something we're uncertain about.
Yeah.
We would have certainty, like gravity. We can't deny it. I mean, it's just here. Ubiquitous presence makes everything function the way it does. So gravity is not something we believe in. I mean, we can, you know, humorously refer to the fact that we don't believe in gravity, but obviously it's incontestable. It's not something that we need to believe in. We know it to be here and true.
You know what, though? You say that, Adam, and this is so interesting because we somehow, a lot of us don't believe in death. And yet it's incontrovertible, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe. That's the best possible answer I can give to that. You know, I think it's important for when we don't know, we have to be able to say we don't know. Because when we try to offer answers to questions that cannot be answered, we're shifting into belief. And it's so easy. It's so easy to say, you know, it's so easy for these immortalists to say, I know I'm not going to die. And if you say, well, is it possible that you're wrong? They would be upset at you. And I think it's equally, you know, I personally believe that we will die. Like, let's get that out there. I am what would be referred to as a deathist by these physical immortalists. But I'm not a judgmental deathist. And at the same time, Who knows? I don't believe that we're going to find some way to eliminate death. But if these people, you know, if these people make some incredible radical breakthrough, well, I guess we'll try to figure out a way to deal with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to John in Oak Cliff. Hi, John.
Yeah, hey, Chris. Another great show. I agree with your guess that we'll die. And I'm intrigued by his immortalist view, which does seem naturally to kind of aim at heaven or proof of heaven or whatever. But I just want to represent what I think is a little bit more original Christian view that really affirms death in that it promises a resurrection from the dead. And I just wonder what he thinks about the idea of a bodily resurrection and how that relates to the immortalism he's talking about.
Thanks for your call.
I had a wonderful series of conversations with a Jesuit priest for this book, and his name is Father Mark Gervais, and he was a film professor at my university, and he was a specialist in avant-garde cinema, particularly the films of Ingmar Bergman, who explored a lot of these ideas. I mean, one of the most famous examples of it is that scene in the film The Seventh Seal, which shows this crusading knight returning from the Crusades, and he is playing chess with death, with the Grim Reaper. And, you know, that's one of the ultimate metaphors of this question. You know, here we all are in this complicated cerebral match with someone who is necessarily going to beat us. As far as the afterlife is concerned, in a whole host of beliefs, Judeo-Christian beliefs, I think it is very meaningful to people to believe or to know, however they want to put it, that once their body dies, there will be some form of, you call it bodily resurrection. Others could speak of reincarnation or perhaps a whole host of other eventualities, and that's the one of the fundamental roles of religion, is to give us ways of envisioning the end of what will come after death. That's what they do. That's one of their prime functions, is to give us a way of making sense of the end, and also a way of dealing with another one of life's great mysteries, which is, where did the universe come from?
So we've talked in this conversation about faith, and we've talked about science and proof. And then there's the third element that you sort of promise in your subtitle, which is magic. And there has been for a very long time a desire to sort of maybe split the difference, right? To find something supernatural that promises to deliver everything we want without maybe the requirements of science or the moral complications of faith.
Magical thinking. Magic is so fascinating. Magic, what's interesting to me is that science, belief, and magic, they all kind of emerge in this interconnected way and evolve in their own ways. And there was times when they were lumped in totally together. And I think that this age is one that still confounds them and confuses them and gets them mixed up with one another. But magic, I mean, you know, magic is the idea that the impossible might actually be possible. And so there's something so magical about the possibility of, let's say, finding the fountain of youth or some sort of elixir that could allow us to never grow old. I mean, that's such a magical idea. Religions don't really tell us, like, hey, there's a way for you to stay young forever. Science may be looking for ways of delaying aging and of extending lifespans, but real scientists aren't really talking about immortality or staying young forever. That's usually pretty fringe hustlers and hype men and pitchmen and pseudoscientists. But it's really magic is where the idea of eternal youth comes in. And that's some of the funnest part of the book, is exploring how we've pursued that dream through time and today.
Well, you had what I can only describe as a really surreal experience with the stage magician David Copperfield. And what's so interesting about this whole thing is that, set this up for us. How did you find out that Copperfield claims to have discovered something like a fountain of youth on his private island?
I was so happy to find that story. I was on a plane and somebody handed out, you know, they give you those complimentary newspapers
right.
that you usually don't read. And I flipped through the first one and I saw this Newswire item about David Copperfield, master illusionist, has found the fountain of youth on his private island in the Bahamas. And it's a liquid that he said has the capability of turning dead insects. You put dead insects in the water and they come back to life and they fly away. And if you put brown leaves in the water, they turn green again. So he said it was this very exciting discovery. And I remember the first newspaper, I read it and I kind of chuckled and I said, well, what a silly story. And then the second time I opened the newspaper and I found the same Newswire item, I thought, huh, I wonder what's really going on there. And then in the third newspaper, it was there as well. And I said, oh, you know, I got to go. I got to be the reporter who goes and finds out what's really going on there. Like, this is obviously ridiculous, but what is really happening there? Like, what's the story behind this story? Like, where did this come from? And so it took a while, but eventually I was able to go down to David Copperfield's island with him for a few days and explore this fountain of youth.
Well, let me jump in. This is the perfect setup for our next break here, and we will finish the story in just a moment. My guest is Adam Leith-Gallner. He is a writer and former editor of Vice magazine. He's also the author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Adam Leith-Gallner, author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So, Adam, the fact that you are a journalist by trade, I'm going to jump out on a limb and assume that you are not a fabulously wealthy person who hangs out with the likes of Oprah and Bill Gates. How did you manage to secure a place for yourself on the island?
Well, the reason you're asking whether I'm wealthy or not is because renting the island costs something like $50,000 a night, and you need to rent it for David Copperfield's island, of course. It's he rents it out. That's part of the idea. And so you can stay there, five-night minimum, around $50,000 a night, so $250,000 to go there. I would love to say I'm the sort of guy who has enough money to do that, but you're right, I'm not. I don't have enough money to do that. But one of the things that journalists can do and reporters can do is explore stories. And so with David Copperfield, I went through the usual channels, which is to approach his publicist and say, I'm interested in writing about the Fountain of Youth. And it was a long journey to make it happen, and a fun journey. It's a funny story, and I think that the story of getting there is as much a part of the story as actually being there. And everybody, you know, everybody who's heard about it is always says, like, how did you manage to do that? Like, how did that happen? And it is a funny story. I don't know if it would probably take me the whole show to recount that story properly, but it's in the book. It's in the book of immortality.
Let's just fast forward to this. Do you believe that he believes that he has discovered anything like the Fountain of Youth, or is this just another illusion?
Well, he was very clear about saying that there's a distinction between what he called puffery. Puffery being his usual magic tricks and illusions. Magicians don't like the term trick, but, you know, his illusions, his stage performances. He said there was a difference between puffery and finding a liquid that reverses genes and hiring scientists to try to figure out how exactly it works and whether its properties can be something that is beneficial for humankind. So he was extremely clear about that. And I grilled him for hours about it. I spoke about it at length with him. And I said, you know, people are not going to believe you. You're a magician. And he said, it doesn't matter. This is something that is meaningful to me. And so do I believe it? Does he believe it? Do I believe that he believes it? I think that one of the great things about magic is that it can make you believe that the impossible might be real. And for sure, we have to suspend our disbelief in all stories. And magicians are masters of that. So yes, he's a magician. But by that same token, there was something so wonderful about what he did, which was give me a story. And I love that. And I'm very grateful to him for that.
Does he look like he said work done?
I don't know. I didn't feel like he'd had work. He looks like he's getting on in years. Mm-hmm. And I mean, certainly the hair is a question mark for a lot of people. but he's funny. He was funny. He's smart. He's a great talker. I mean, magicians, one of the great tools in the magician toolkit is something called patter, mm-hmm. the ability to talk in a way that kind of distracts you. And it's one of the central arts of misdirection. And boy, is he a good talker.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I was just going to share this with you. I think that most people that I knew and that I read about who took a lot of psychedelic drugs, their experience was that you do, in fact, die when you take these drugs, and you don't come back as the same person at all. But you do realize that time is the element that brings, is a concept that brings fear to people who do legitimately fear death. And once you realize that time just simply doesn't exist, your fear of death is that it doesn't exist either in a realistic way.
Adam, any thoughts on that?
I love that. I love that. Thank you for the call. I mean, there's several things I could say to that. I think that I definitely haven't done enough psychedelic drugs to say whether you actually experience death in them. But I think I've heard a lot of other descriptions that come close to that, and certainly a lot of visionary poetry that has nothing to do with psychedelic drugs also seems to have tapped into those kind of transcendental moments, you know, from Whitman to Blake, et cetera. These are people who had what people who took psychedelic drugs felt like they could relate to, you know, these visions of the eternal. And then as far as time being an illusion, well, I think, was it Gödel that proved that we can't, that time isn't real? Like, I think advanced physics would agree with that. I think physicists are, you know, at one point we thought time was an illusion, but now I think the consensus is, you know, that time doesn't exist, or, you know, like, yeah, it exists, but we can't prove that it exists, or it's just this construct. I mean, I don't know. That's one of those, you know, things we all take for granted again, you know, like gravity. But what is it really? What is time? You know, and what is consciousness? Yeah, you know, we should probably take a bunch of mushrooms and discuss it.
not on this show, but maybe in another venue. So, speaking of time, you also looked into people who are interested in cryonics, which is, and I'm going to just sort of basically explain this, the idea of at the moment you die, you are very quickly frozen, so that at the time at which maybe science does have the ability to bring you back to life, that will be a possibility because your body won't have degraded. Is that essentially correct?
Yeah, I saw cryonics as a form of, it's like a burial home, or it's like a cemetery. I mean, you go into the Cryonics Institute, and there are these big thermoses, and they're filled with each one has five bodies in them. And the bodies are placed inside sleeping bags, and they're placed head first. And so they're kind of resting in this vertical repose, head down, in these tanks filled with liquid nitrogen. The people in these tanks are dead. To all of us, that's what we would say. They are dead. They're cadavers. They're corpses. But to cryonicists, what they would say is that these people are in suspended animation, and they are awaiting the time when science will figure out how to reanimate them and bring them back to life. And so that's their belief. Their belief is that if you are buried in this way, that eventually you will be able to be brought back to life. Now, obviously, there is no proof whatsoever that could work, and obviously, you know, the complications of cells exploding in the water, in cells freezing, and you know, in organs and in brains, and the complications of how to properly cryopreserve those things so that they could ultimately be regenerated at some point. I mean, it's such a massively impossible scenario. Yet, for some people, it is deeply meaningful, and it is how they make sense of death. And again, it's another story, but if it helps people cope with the senselessness of death, then I think it's a valid story, and that's what I got out of it. I it's very easy to ridicule and mock and think that it's just ludicrous, and there's not a lot of people who signed up for it either. You know, this is really like just, you know, it's in the hundreds of people, not the thousands. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I remember leaving there thinking, oh, it's just another example of one of the ways that we as humans try to cope with the inexplicable. And in that sense, I believe it's valid.
It's not so different, I suppose, from, you know, sending the pharaohs of Egypt off to the next life supplied for the world when the time comes.
Yeah, it's another version of that, you know, like they're properly mummified in ice, I guess. I mean, there's a lot of leaps that you need to make to be a cryonicist. It's really an out there one. You have to believe that first off there's going to be a time when medical science can cure all illnesses, because that's one of the kind of precursors, is that medical science is going to be this thing that can make people superhuman. And second off, you need to also make this other leap, which is that there's going to be a way somehow to, you know, bring dead things back to life. That's a
yeah.
pretty massive leap. And then another one is that the bodies that have only the bodies that have been stored in this particular way are the ones that are going to be the ones that we can bring back to life, rather than just any old pile of bones in the earth. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is really a logic stretching enterprise, but this has nothing to do with rationality or logic. This has everything to do with beliefs. And sure, they can couch it in as much scientific terminology as they want, but ultimately it is a way of burying yourself. And if you think it's temporary, that's fine. But, you know, there's so many other ways that we can, you know, we can put ourselves in firecrackers, and we can send our ashes in rocket ships into outer space, or we can put it into lead in pencils and give it to our loved ones so they can write letters with us. I mean, there are so many ways of dealing with a dead body, and it seems to me that cryonics is just another form of that.
There is a sort of beautiful optimism to that the world will be a place we want to return to at the time theoretically it was possible to bring us back.
That makes me think of Robert Ettinger, the founder of this movement, who just died recently and, of course, is preserved cryonically in his Cryonics Institute outside of Detroit. But so is his mother, and both of the two wives that he had. His first wife died, and she's in there. And then his second wife, after she passed on, he remarried. And when she died, she also entered in there. And so people said to him before he died, they said, you know, what's going to happen when you guys all come back to life, you and your two wives, how's it, what's it going to be like for them? And he said, well, you know, there's different types of problems out there. You know, there's what you might say, there's good problems and there's bad problems. And I'd say that's probably a really good problem.
So you survived what could have been a fatal accident when you were a teenager. You're still a young man now. I mean, have you thought about the way that your relationship to the question of your own mortality will evolve as you get closer to the point at which your death wouldn't be an accident, it would be sort of inevitable?
I mean, I would venture to say that my death is inevitable already.
Well,
I mean, we can
right.
all go at any moment.
Imminent maybe is a better word.
Yeah, imminent. Yes, imminent. Oh, yeah. How? I mean, I don't know. I think that, you know, speaking to people who were in their final moments and in their final years, there was something very comforting about that to me. You know, the human spirit is so resilient, and we can take any circumstance and find something meaningful in it. And so I do have confidence that when my time eventually comes, and it will come, whenever that is, that I will have the courage to face it with, I don't know, grace, something resembling grace, and to accept it. And I don't see myself as somebody who's torn up by a fear of death. You know, I didn't write this book because I was terrified of dying. And like, I have friends like that. I have friends who are, many of my artist friends are people who are just consumed with dread about the possibility of their demise. I don't share that dread. I think it could be kind of a relief, you know, when this is finished. You spoke about how life entails suffering, and I agree with that. But I think, you know, life also entails beauty, and I think it entails equal parts, good and bad. And I think it's important to value this brief, extraordinary opportunity we've been granted here, a lifetime. And who knows? Who knows how we'll deal with it when it ends, but let's see.
Have you longed at any point in your life for the kind of certainty that many people of faith have about where they're going after they die?
Yes and no. Yes and no. And that's something else I've heard a lot of people say. They say, I just wish I could be like those Hasidic Jews, those Orthodox believers who just, you know, they have so much certainty and their whole life is determined by their relationship to that certainty. I mean, sure, that might be interesting, but I also think I'm a writer and I'm a storyteller, and for me, I believe in uncertainty, and I think uncertainty is one of the things that shapes my own outlook. Keats, the poet, the great poet Keats, said that one of the things that poets need to have is what he called negative capability, which he defined as the ability to be in uncertain situations without trying to make sense of them, like to inhabit mysteries and to allow them to just be what they are without trying to define them or understand them. And I loved finding that. And I loved finding that letter he wrote, because I feel like that's how I feel.
Adam Leith-Gallner has written for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Guardian. He is the former editor of Vice magazine and now author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Adam, it's been a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.